I'm Phil DeLuca.
I'm Nate Burgess.
And Sean can't be with us, but he's with us in spirit. And we are Commanderin. Thanks for listening, everybody. We focus on topics the community wants to hear about and talk to interesting people along the way, but never, ever talk about three banned topics, do we, Nate?
Mm-mm.
Religion, politics, and Hearthstone. You can find us on all the social medias. I'm not going to name any of them, Nate.
Yay.
By searching for Commanderin MTG Podcast. This week, we have a wonderful show lined up for you. We have none other than the eater of the color pie, the recluse of Gitrog, Ethan Fleischer.
Hello, hello. I'm Ethan Hey. Fleischer. I'm a magic designer with Magic R&D, and I was on the development team for Shadows Over Innistrad, the newest Ooh. Magic the Gathering set.
Oh, that's excellent. What a wonderful introduction. And of course, you were here on the show not 10 episodes, well, exactly 10 episodes ago.
That's right. I was here. I talked a little about both of the Gatewatch and just general things about magic design in my career as a magic player.
In my opinion, that was one of our best episodes yet.
Yeah, I believe so.
I think it was the best episode yet of any podcast.
It might have been. We'll have to poll our listeners to see if that was actually the best podcast ever. I'm sure it'll turn out the way we expect it to.
Things usually do.
We are very excited to have you back. And right after this wonderful Shadows spoiler season, when people listen to this episode, they know that we're recording it right after spoilers have ended. We're happy to assume that you still have all of your fingers, or at least the ones you had when you left us.
Yeah, I haven't lost any further fingers since our last episode. That means I haven't violated the color pie, which are the rules about what effects we can put on cards of a certain color.
Right.
I am learning. I learn through pain, and I am learning to be better about respecting the color pie.
You know, what are a few fingers for that sort of education? Nothing.
That's right. I get to keep my wonderful job in the R&D dungeon.
And you get to make 10 mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I get 10 mistakes before it's all
and
over.
And you don't need to throw a frisbee. No.
No. I'm not very active. I'm a nerd.
That's better than cats. They only get 9 mistakes.
Wow. So what have you been up to in the last few months? Been doing anything?
Oh, my goodness. I have been working on magic design. I've been playing as much Commander as I can find time to.
Excellent.
I recently played some Magic Online. I got involved in Magic Online Sealed League. It was totally awesome. I got to play Magic Online on my own schedule rather than having to sit down for 3 hours for a draft and a tournament. And I just bought a house with all of the money that we made selling booster packs to your listeners.
That's right, because that money goes directly to you, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we put it all in a big pit, and we have one of those big transparent tubes with a fan that blows the money around, and you get to be in the tube for 1 minute, and however much money you can grab is how much you
That's
get to
awesome.
Take home. And I got lucky this year.
Have they gone back to $10,000 bills?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, great.
Do you get to add, like, the flying squirrel membranes between your arms and feet to be able to grab more money?
No. There are strict rules about what sort of clothes you can wear in there.
Oh.
We are gamers, after all.
And so violating the color pie is really a self-reinforcing punishment, isn't it?
That's true. It's really hard to grab money if you don't have any fingers.
Yeah. Do you do the old, like, you try to suck a bill to your mouth, like,
no, that sounds really filthy.
Well, like a chipmunk, you can store them in your cheeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Some people do that, but they inevitably get seriously ill. So
yeah. And then the people who have to cough those bills out, it just ruins it for the next people.
Yep.
Yep. Yep.
Mm. Wow. Well, glad to hear that life in R&D is returning to the early days in magic.
Yeah, yeah. It's we're really going back to our roots.
Well, we have a ton of questions for you, and we're going to take, of course, last time we took the design angle, this time we're going to take the development angle. But first, a little bit of news. Ethan, I'm sure you know by now that we have a Patreon page up, and we are happy to welcome new listeners to our patron community. We have a chat going with some of the patrons who've donated at the $10 level, and they helped us actually assemble this podcast. And I do believe one or two of them are watching the show notes right now so they can see where we are in the show as we tap through.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty
exciting.
Cool. It is. And we're thinking about enhancing it. I don't know if you're a big fan of a lot of podcasts or if you only listen to ours. I mean, I'd understand it if you only listen to ours.
Oh, no, I only listen to podcasts on which I'm a guest.
Oh, great.
Just the episodes where I'm a guest. That's all I'm really interested in is myself.
Right, right. Totally understandable.
I'm much the same way. That's why I listen to this podcast.
Nate actually listens to our podcast more frequently than anybody else.
Yeah.
Nate often listens to them 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, I blow the curve for all the statistics pages.
Yeah,
we have a similar problem in Wizards of the Coast. You know, everyone can brag about when they started Magic, and inevitably there's somebody nearby who started Magic quite a bit before it was ever released.
Well, is Mons still playing?
Yeah, Mons is playing. He was not there actually from the beginning, but Charlie Catino and Bill Rose were playtesters for Magic before it was published. So
do you guys wait until they leave the room and then start talking about it?
Yeah, we basically have to.
Yeah. That must actually be pretty cool. I'd love to hear playtest stories. I wonder if what is Charlie's voice? Is it as smooth as yours?
That's a little higher pitch than mine. About as smooth as mine, I'd say.
Well, maybe we'll ask him someday, but not this day. This day, we're going to continue with our news, and we're going to talk about how Google DeepMind, now it's moving past Go, and it's analyzing Magic, the Gathering cards, and cards from a card game we will not discuss on this show. So pretty cool. Are you looking forward to receiving design direction from a computer?
Oh, yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to the day I can just push a button on my computer and it'll design a Magic set for me.
Awesome.
Much like, you know, Photoshop and such makes digital art a lot easier.
Yeah.
You just push the art button.
Yep.
And you get a digital painting.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's going to be sweet. It's going to be a lot more relaxing not having to do any work anymore.
Yeah. And at that point, you just hand it over to the creative team. They flavor it and you release a set.
Yeah.
How popular is the Robo Rosewater Twitter account with the development team?
Oh, we're not allowed to look at any of the Robo Rosewater things, I'm afraid. Those count as outside submissions.
Oh,
and,
no.
So we are forbidden to look at them. I'm told that they're hilarious.
Someday, when you retire from Wizards of the Coast, you will have hours and hours of pleasure going through all of those images.
That's true. I'll get to save them for later.
Yep. Yep.
I've been saving some Star Trek episodes for later, and I can save those for later.
Oh, which Star Trek episodes?
All the ones I haven't seen yet. You know, like some people would have, like, by my age, would have watched every episode of Star Trek if they really liked Star Trek, but I'm doling them out over the years so that I'll always have some new Star Trek episode to look forward to.
Are there any particular sub-series that you're omitting or?
Oh, just Star Trek. I'm not really very interested in any of those sequel series.
All right.
Oh, really?
I'm not sure exactly how many I've seen, but I've seen quite a lot of them at this point, but I'm saving a few.
So you're talking about what the fans call the original series.
That's right. That's right.
Shatnertown.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I've never heard it called Shatnertown, actually. I agreed with you just to be agreeable, but...
but it works, right?
I was taken by surprise as well. Wow, that's excellent. Well, I'm sorry that you haven't seen any Robo-Rose water, but at the same time, I'm envious of you because, you know, when you're lying there on your deathbed, because that's the only time you'll be allowed to retire, right?
Yeah.
You'll have somebody, maybe the newest intern, bring you what will probably be a holographic tablet full of Robo-Rose water pose.
That will truly be what I want to be doing on my deathbed, I'm sure.
Priorities.
Now, have you been through the employee pre-release yet?
No, that's not till Thursday.
Oh, okay.
Today's Tuesday. We're recording this, so right. I still have. But we did sneak in a draft in R&D just for R&D a couple of weeks ago. So I got to draft the set with real cards.
Wow, pretty sneaky. That's great.
Oh God, it was so fun.
Oh.
So fun. Black Red Madness was the deck that I drafted,
mm-hmm.
and I love Madness. It is such a fun mechanic.
Oh, we're going to get into Madness.
Mm-hmm.
What, in terms of Commander, are you excited to put together in paper? Just like last time, it was Tazri. Or am I saying Tazri? What's the official pronunciation?
I think it's Tazri.
Tazri.
Well, the thing that really excites me for Commander purposes, actually, is revisiting one of my very first Commander decks, Jaya Ballard Taskmage.
Mm.
Now, she is a spell shaper. These are some creatures that you can spend some mana and tap them and discard a card to do an effect. And most spell shapers just have one effect, but Jaya Ballard has three different possible effects, each with a different casting cost. And what really goes well with Jaya Ballard, of course, is Madness cards, because mm-hmm. you can discard a Madness card to get one of her powerful effects, but then you also get whatever the Madness card is at the same time. So I want to completely remake my Jaya Ballard deck using lots of Shadows over Innistrad cards, and it's going to be awesome, because she's possibly my favorite legendary creature, or at least she was for many years, so can't wait to bring her out of vacation.
So
great.
Did you convince the development team to add Madness in order to make your Jaya Ballard deck more powerful?
No. I'm not above doing things like that. But in this case, I was pretty skeptical about Madness, actually. I didn't think it was going to work out very well. But I was happy to be proven wrong.
Okay, so Jaya Ballard helps prove that wrong.
Yeah, or just the set itself. It plays very beautifully, and Madness works very well. And I didn't think it could be done, but fortunately, the people who had to make the sets knew what they were doing.
I promise, listeners, and Ethan and Nate and me, we will get to a discussion of Madness. But the burning question that everyone wants to know the answer to, everybody who understands the importance of such things, who created the Frog God of Gitrog?
So the Frog God of Gitrog has a long history of creation. This was a complex process involving many hands. I was reviewing the questions beforehand, and I did a little sleuthing around Magic R&D to find out what the genesis of this hideous creature is. Why don't we talk first about what is the Frog God of Gitrog, so that our listeners know what the heck we're talking about here.
Oh, our listeners know it. They better.
Well, what if they... I'm just going to say it anyway, because I like to say it. All right, so the Gitrog monster is a 3 black-green legendary creature frog horror. It's a 6/6. It has Death Touch. It says, at the beginning of your upkeep, sacrifice the Gitrog monster unless you sacrifice a land. You may play an additional land on each of your turns. Whenever one or more land cards are put into your graveyard from anywhere, draw a card.
Mm-hmm.
And the illustration is this giant frog monster with some poor guy's arm sticking out of his mouth.
That's a pretty good picture.
I first just want to note that if you look at the card Chubtoad from, I believe, Legends, it's basically the same illustration.
Mirrored with the arm pointing up, sir.
That's true. I mean, there are some differences, but the concept is very similar. So how it went down was, I believe James Wyatt was preparing for the concept push. This is where we get a bunch of artists into R&D, and they draw sketches of everything. They draw architecture and costumes and monsters and all kinds of things, all of the aspects of physical culture that we will use to show to the artists so that they're all kind of working within the same world. So he came up with several ideas for sort of miscellaneous, hideous monsters that are these like gigantic cosmic beasts that people could worship and things. As people go more and more crazy in Innistrad, they start turning away from the Church of Avacyn and start worshiping these horrible monsters.
I knew it.
So one of them was the Gitrog Toad. All right. So that passed the process off to Steve Prescott, who was one of the artists doing the sketching. And he sketched this monstrous toad with eyeballs all over it. And then Sam Burley, who is the concept artist that we keep on staff, he works in the building all the time, evolved the design further into this thing with gibbering mouths all over it. And then at this point, even when we just saw the Prescott version, before Sam did his fancier version, the design team was really excited. Like, this thing looked awesome. We were like, we have to make this card. We need to make a card of this thing because it's just too awesome. So everybody was super excited about it. So I believe Mark Gottlieb, who is the lead designer of Shadows Over Innistrad, came up with the Sacrificing a Land and Explore combo. And at some point, Eric Lauer, who's the head developer, suggested that it should have Death Touch. So the design went forward and then moved on to development. It wasn't changed very much in development, if I recall correctly. It was pretty much perfect at that point. And then we got the final illustration, which is this very polished presentation of a horrible frog beast. And then of course somebody, was it Ichow that wrote the story about it? There's a short story on our website that you can read about the Gitrog Toad also, which is quite good in my opinion.
There is.
There's a whole story about it. It's, I believe, called the Gitrog Toad or the Gitrog Monster. I do recommend it.
Well, we'll have to trawl through the website in order to find that.
So how often is it that a card design is based on the concept art instead of vice versa?
I would say more often it is the design comes first and the concept follows from it. But, we try to use every part of the buffalo. So usually if there's a good concept in the style guide, if it hasn't been used by the end, we will try to find a place to use it. But in this case, we latched onto it very early. It was clearly awesome. We clearly needed to do it. This was not one of the leftover scraps. This was the choice cut right here.
So you recognize awesomeness and you use it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's great. DerkokeXXL from Twitter asks, is it more fun to design a card top down or bottom up?
For me, at least, it's more fun to design top down. I feel like you end up making designs that are frequently a little weirder and a little wackier, and they're more likely to be different. When you design bottom up, a lot of the time, it will be derivative of some other design, which is fine. We don't want to like radically change everything from set to set, but. Yeah, top-down design is fun, and when it really comes together properly, it's the most satisfying thing.
Yeah, I bet you get to carve and shape the mechanics to suit the ideal in your mind, as opposed to, like you said, having to fit it to some preconceived notion of how the mechanics work.
Yeah, and you just end up with a more distinctive, just something that just doesn't make sense in any other context. It's like this game mechanic belongs here and nowhere else, and that's always pretty exciting when you find the perfect place for a card.
Now, I risk severe punishment in asking this, but do you think it was too soon to have a paragon of voracious consumption in another set of Magic?
A paragon of, you mean Are you referring to the Gitrog toad in this case?
The Gitrog monster, yes.
The Gitrog monster?
I mean, obviously, it likes to eat. It's a consumer. Yeah,
I mean, it's hungry, but a lot of us are hungry. I feel like there are a lot of people who can sympathize with that. We just had Ulamog in the last block, but I feel like the Gitrog monster is a little easier to identify with than Ulamog. And I don't know. I think it's okay. And I think that the Gitrog monster is more than just consumption, right?
Yes.
There's more to him than that.
Yeah, there is. There's more to it. Occasionally, he ceases to be hungry.
That's right.
As opposed to Ulamog, of course.
Yes. The Ulamog is ceaseless. And there's something, you know, earthy and believable about the Gitrog monster, whereas Ulamog is this unknowable, unfathomable cosmic being from beyond the stars, and it's just, he's a little bit too weird, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. A little too tentacly, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you think the Gitrog monster releases hallucinogens on the warts on its back?
It seems likely. He's got all of these cultists worshiping him and freaking out all the time, so.
He does have death
probably.
Touch.
Mm-hmm.
That's true, yeah. He might have some sort of poison, which, you know, if it's in small amounts, it might produce a hallucinogenic response, but a large enough dose can kill.
Do you think that arm coming out of his mouth is a cultist who worshipped a little too long and a little too closely?
I would assume so.
Mm.
Or it could be a victim of the sinister cult.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To appease it while they lick its back.
Exactly.
Well, you don't stay a cultist for long if you don't know how to avoid the death attacks. You need sacrifices for that.
Yep.
Apostles, perhaps. Born in the shadows.
Or just people who haven't seen the light yet.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And maybe a little too slow in seeing the light, and so that's why they're a meal now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Neustra, it's not a nice place.
No, it's a pretty rough place. I mean, it's not as rough as Zendikar in its last few weeks, but it's...
Not yet.
Not yet, exactly. We want to ask all about Eldritch Moon, so prepare your stiff arms, sir.
I promise that I will tell you nothing about Eldritch Moon.
Ah, you just told us something.
Oh, man, you tricked me.
Yes, we did it.
So the word moon implies lycanthropes, right?
Uh-oh.
Absolutely. The transformations of the werewolves of Innistrad are governed by the moon.
Yeah. Like in a legendary capacity, right?
I don't know what you're driving at.
I guess the I'm just going to take a wild guess here. I'm going to guess that Nate is referring to the legendary werewolf that was released in this set.
Oh, is that a thing we were supposed to do?
Some might say. In fact, let me.
We did a werewolf planeswalker though.
Yeah, you did. She's pretty cool.
It was episode 31 that this designer from Wizards of the Coast mentioned that he's fully on board with meeting the expectations of the players. And that sort of echoes what the head designer, Mark Rosewater, has said often in his both his blog and his podcast. And almost any chance he gets to write a word or two down, one of them is meet and the other is expectations. And so...
That is absolutely true. We definitely like to do that. If only somebody had told us that they wanted a werewolf legendary creature.
Yeah.
I'm sure we would have put it into Shadows Over Innistrad, but we didn't hear anything about it.
Yeah, totally missed. The community was not vocal enough, clearly, about that. So
maybe we'll go back to Innistrad some other set.
Maybe. And maybe some planeswalker that would have been a great legendary werewolf might... lose her spark, let's say, and become a legendary werewolf instead.
Or just go back in time.
It happened to Teferi, right? He lost his spark.
He did, yeah.
And it happened to Obnixilus for a while.
Yeah.
Or you could just have alternate timelines and just have a previous historical version.
That's true.
Sure.
We did discuss that in our last episode, which, of course...
Don't let the creative team hear that stuff about alternate timelines, by the way. They don't want to hear that stuff anymore.
It hasn't did worked
it
well.
A few things up?
Let's just say the Cons of Tarkir block was quite a challenge.
Especially preceding the Zendikar block. A few wrinkles to work out there, like why wasn't Ugin present?
Yep, well, fortunately, that's all done now.
Yeah, yep. Water under the bridge, as it were, right?
That's right.
No one would be holding a grudge about...
We learn things all the time from making these sets.
I mean, it's almost like a J.J. Abrams plot.
Yeah, things we should do and things we shouldn't do.
What was the number one thing you learned that you shouldn't do? Can you answer that, or is this...
I think I can answer that. The number one thing that we shouldn't do when coming up with a concept for a block is come up with a concept for a block that requires three separate concept pushes, one for each set in the block. That, as it turns out, is not a very good idea.
Especially in a two-set block structure.
Well, yeah. It would fortunately be impossible now since we only have two sets per block. Right. But so won't do that again.
Kind of leaves the community waiting for the other shoe to drop, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
The third shoe, if you have 3 feet.
Right. Things that come in threes.
Yeah. And may or may not be shaped like a moon.
What?
A shoe that's shaped like a moon? Like a moon boot?
Yeah, like a moon boot. Big right. Moon boot. You wear it when walking on the moon, which would have to be even bigger than your boot, which is itself pretty big.
I don't know where you're going with this.
I'm delirious still from the desert. Let's talk about grudges for a minute.
All right.
It's smooth segues like that, really, that separate us from professionals.
The professionals are over there.
So the Cons block maybe left some people wondering why their allies may or may not have been available to assist them when it came time for the Eldrazi to, say, escape their prison on their plane. And so Nahiri, set to watch over Zendikar, went, called for help. Ugin wasn't available for whatever reason, and Sorin apparently sent her call to voicemail? Because we know Sorin was just hanging out. He wasn't doing much.
I believe that's what happened.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what happened on Sorin's end, to be honest. Nobody does yet.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody does. Somebody in the writing team knows. But and it's possible that I know and I'm just not saying. But as far as the publicly available information goes,
right.
Nobody's quite sure whether Sorin received that call or not.
Presumably it was something grim.
Yeah.
He's a grim nemesis, isn't he?
Well, yeah, that's the word on the street.
Yeah. So it must have been grim.
So she is a harbinger of something, Nahiri.
Yeah, and she's clearly mad as hell also.
Yeah.
At Sorin.
Yeah, she's pretty pissed at him. Oh, can I say pissed, Nate?
Probably, yeah.
I was waiting for the
boop. I think you just did. So.
I did, twice even. Yeah, she's kind of mad.
Yeah.
When you were developing the set, at this point, did you know that she was mad?
Yes, we knew she was mad, and we knew why. And it's for totally awesome reasons that I can't tell you yet. But when you find out, it's going to be sweet. Like I said, I can't tell you. It might have been sweet love, but it's Magic the Gathering, so probably not.
But that's a red concept, and she's now part red.
It's true. I'm not ruling it out as a possibility, but I am just saying that there's not a lot of sweet love in this game, I'm afraid. It's mostly about anger and
50 Shades of
people
Boros.
On fire. Yeah.
Yeah. Will we see a Sorin vengeant?
No, I mean, Nahiri is the one who's vengeant right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a little upset.
Yep.
Sorry. All right. This is
right. And you were asking what she was a harbinger of. Right?
Yeah. Like. So, what's going on with the story that we can? I mean, we see everything, but we're waiting for something. We're waiting for something big to happen and/or show up.
That's right, because there are two sets in this block, right? We've got Shadows Over Innistrad, which is about to be released, and then we have Eldritch Moon, which will be released in the distant, misty future. So,
July, I think.
She's a harbinger, but of what or who, you will just have to be patient about to find out, because it's not in this set, that's for sure.
But the misty future has tentacles, apparently, based on the background art.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen that. I don't know. Maybe.
Mm. Yeah, it has tentacles, but then there's also the card Gone Missing, which if you look at the card Gone Missing, it has a hat floating in some rippling pools of water that may or may not have dark lines in it.
I didn't notice the dark lines. They're really dark lines.
And but
what does that mean?
But under the hat is a rather symmetrical pattern that looks a lot like a face with black lines coming out.
Oh, God, that's spooky looking. I never noticed that. I just saw the hat floating there.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's all kinds of creepy stuff going on in the background of this art, of various arts. And so there's all sorts of clues. And if you look for the clues, you might be able to figure out what's going on. But we made it pretty ambiguous, I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, clues. You did.
And there's apparently inkblot tests and certain art.
But there's also
Of it is just random patterns, and you know, the horrible screaming faces that you see are just indicative of your state of mind, I'm afraid.
Yeah, all those packs of zombies with the eyes on their hands, and it's not indicative of anything.
Yep, something's going on here, and it's not good.
No, it's not good. It's going to be pretty horrible. A lot of horrors this set, too. We haven't seen horrors in a couple of years. So, developmentally, why no Legendary Werewolf?
So, it's pretty simple.
Yeah.
We needed this, from a developmental standpoint, we needed a red-green planeswalker to balance the colors in the standard format.
Yeah.
And so there was some discussion about, oh, should we bring back Domri Raid, and maybe he's here? And the creative team said, no, we don't like it. Why would Domri Raid come here?
Would he have transformed into an adult?
No, he isn't much older than he was. It hasn't been very much time since we last saw him. But Some of the members of the development team were pretty excited about bringing Domri back, but the creative team didn't like it. It wasn't going to fit with their story. So we ended up making a new planeswalker, Arlen Cord, and she is a native to Innistrad, and she's a werewolf.
Oh, she's a native?
She was born on Innistrad, and we didn't want to have both a legendary werewolf and a planeswalker werewolf in the same set.
I can kind of see that. There were a lot of legendary allies, though, in the same set that had a legendary planeswalker ally. Not quite an ally type, of course, but, you know, like Gideon's second and third.
That's true. That's true.
A lot of members of Gideon's coterie, as it were included in the set, so.
Yeah, the two color cards are... they take up more than their fair share of space in the set, if you know what I mean, because they don't fit in as many decks.
It's true. So, Zach Williams, who is at ZW87, says, what do we have to do to get a legendary werewolf? And I guess it's wait.
Well, you could wait. I am susceptible to bribery also. You can just send me envelopes full of cash to the address for Wizards of the Coast, and who knows? Maybe you'll get some results.
Do you think we/our listeners should bid on whether or not we see a legendary werewolf or a Thopter Queen first?
Yeah, I mean, the highest bidder. I can't guarantee anything, but I can promise to try.
Yeah. But the next set is Eldritch Moon and not Eldritch Thopter Queen.
Also, yeah, I mean, but, you know, there are, I have full access to the database, and somebody might not even notice if I just change one of the cards.
Yeah, the next 1/1 flying token Just change that to a colorless artifact creature token.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, whoever sends me the most money wins, I guess. But unless I get caught and fired, in which case, everybody loses.
This is a good time to mention the Patreon campaign we're running. Nate, do you want to add anything else to the legendary werewolf discussion?
No, I think we can move on.
At Rogue Artificer is glad the frogs are getting their day, though. But he's wondering if he needs to stock up on pitchforks if there's no legendary werewolf soon.
I think it's wise to stock up on pitchforks. You know, whether or not there is a legendary werewolf in the near future, there's bound to be, we're bound to do something that is going to warrant pitchforks. So you might as well, you know, if they're on sale or whatever.
Yeah, it's true. You want to get in early, like Dictate of Erebos.
Yep.
And you don't want to be unprepared in a situation where you want to throw a bunch of pitchforks.
That's right, because, you know, forming a mob should be a spontaneous thing. That's the way they used to do it in the old days, and I really think that's the best way to do it.
And if you happen to be there with a booth and some pitchforks for sale...
Yeah, you can't form a mob and then go down to Home Depot and then wait in line at the cashier with all your pitchforks.
It just ruins the mood.
Do you recommend fiberglass handles on the pitchforks or wooden handles?
I personally prefer to go very old school, to the fully wooden Frankenstein rake.
Oh, yeah. Yep. And good against vampires.
Biodegradable.
That's true, yeah. It's handy that way.
Do you have any particular form? Like, have you studied pitchfork katas or anything like that?
No, I'm not really that into, enough into angry mobs to have studied hard. I prefer to just, do it comes
It wasn't
naturally.
A very good card.
Yeah. Counted how many swamps your opponents had or something.
Yeah. Limited use, shall we say. And of course, we know we want to base our hate against islands. At Johnny Crass wants to know if you're ready to admit the frog god spring will replace Eldrazi winter. Hashtag all hail frog god.
It seems likely. It seems likely. I've heard some promising reports from the FFL, but they just keep chanting the same thing over and over again.
Do you have a recording? So, what are they chanting?
I don't have a recording. It's not in any language known to man.
We'll see if we can get people on that to maybe catch a few snippets of the recording.
Mm-hmm. I've tried, but every time I try to record it, the tape recorders just starts going up in smoke.
What was the biggest challenge in developing the Planeswalkers for the set? Was it balancing the colors against all the others?
The biggest challenge of developing the Planeswalkers. I don't feel qualified to answer that question in all seriousness. Most of my work on the development team involved limited playtest. Most of the constructed playtesting was done by the Future League, which is our dedicated constructed playtest team. And I am a filthy casual, and so I generally do not participate in the FFL.
Did a couple of the playtest cards sort of sneak their way into your commander decks at home?
No, I don't do that sort of thing. When I'm playtesting a commander product, then I'll playtest cards in the context of commander, but no, I don't. We don't playtest the cards and booster releases in commander decks. And I try to keep my commander decks suitable for public presentation because I like to go out in the world and play commander with people.
Yeah, I know. I was just being a little bit silly there. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to make you uncomfortable at all.
That's all right. It's all right.
So during the design process, in regards to releasing a certain set, how much does Commander come into consideration in deciding whether a creature is legendary or not?
So it really varies depending on who's working on the team. Some designers are much more cognizant of Commander than others. You know, if you look at Ken Nagel or myself, we're really into Commander. Like, it's our favorite format. So we definitely give it a lot of thought when we're deciding what kind of legendary creatures should be in the set. someone like Mark Rosewater, he's theoretically aware of Commander. He understands that it's an important format, but it is not nearly as much in the forefront of his mind because he doesn't enjoy multiplayer Magic. So it's not something that he understands as well as those of us that play a lot of Commander.
Nate, are you asking because it seems like there are an awful lot, and by that I mean a wonderful amount of Commander-relevant cards in the last three sets, counting Shadows as released already?
I was asking as a general design question in regards to legendary creatures.
Really. Yeah, I think that, you know, some of the legendary creatures in a set will be deliberately designed specifically for Commander players. You look at General Tazri from Oath of the Gatewatch, was very much engineered to be for Commander. But, you know, a lot of other cards are engineered more to be standard playable. You look at Kalitas, Traitor to Get, that is engineered to be very powerful in standard. And you can use it as a Commander, it's fine, but it's not...
Oh, yeah.
It's not optimized for the Commander experience.
Oh, it could be.
Wow.
It could be, but it wasn't designed to be. Right? It was designed to be a standard, standard playable card. And, you know, obviously the players will do what they want to with the cards. And that's what's one of the great things about Magic is sometimes you'll design a card for one purpose and it'll be used for something completely different that surprises you and it's exciting.
Is the legendary designation for a creature more relevant for limiting the amount of cards repetition in standard and modern and other formats than it is for Commander?
We rarely use the legendary designation as a blunt tool to limit how many copies of a card you can have. If you look at like Mox Opal or Thalia, the original Thalia, right? Like, those are cards that needed the legendary designation to keep from breaking the game. But something like Kalitas is merely very powerful and very efficient. Maybe if it wasn't legendary, it couldn't be quite as powerful or quite as efficient, but it's not a key design component. It's just like, how can we make this card a little cooler and a little more distinctive? It can be legendary. Or, you know, really, we really wanted to just have the character Kalitas in the set, so we designed a card for him.
So sometimes it's story reasons.
Yeah. A lot of the time it's story reasons. You know, like if working on, say I was working on my own set, I would get some direction from the writing team. We want this character to appear and that character and this other character. And I would say, well, okay, but I really want to enable a commander deck in these two colors and these three colors. I want to put some other characters in there. So there'll be a lot of back and forth. So some of it is driven by the desires of design, and some of it is driven by the desires of the creative team. And, you know, not everyone is always going to be satisfied. We try to come to an effective compromise, and we don't want to have too many legendary creatures. Once you get above a certain number, it gets hard for people to build constructed decks because people don't like to put four of a legendary creature in their deck unless it's really, really important and key to their deck. So we want people to be able to collect the cards and get play sets of things.
Okay.
Wow. That's excellent, Nate. That you two have me off in like just sort of thinking about the implications of all that. My apologies. Does the legendary status allow you to put like Audric Lunark Marshall's abilities on a rare card? Right? Is that sort of a mitigator?
I don't think that really has any effect on something like Audric. I think we could have done Audric as a non-legendary creature if we wanted to, but it was such a intriguing build around design. I think that
yeah, he is.
Having it potentially be your commander is definitely upside, because then you always have access to him and you can make a really strange commander deck with him.
Now, is Audric somebody that design or development inserted without necessarily it being a request from creative? Again, I'm not trying to hint at any story or something. Looking at the legendary creature, Audric seems like he's sort of peripheral to the story.
I am not sure, but my assumption is that that was a creative ask. So Audric was originally a character, I believe, in Magic 2013. He was one of the legendary creatures from there. And I would assume that the creative team wanted to bring him back because he's an important person on Innistrad, and we want to, you know, check in, find out what he's up to. So, the story about him has not been revealed yet, but there will be a short story about him coming up in a few weeks. And then there's going to be the Art of Magic the Gathering Innistrad that's coming out. I'm not sure exactly when the release is for that, but should be a bunch of information about Audric in there also.
Yeah, I look at it. Okay, so let's go back to Kalidas, right? So was Kalidas a creative ask, or was that something that you guys...
Yes.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, Kelly Diggs asked me if we could put Kalidas in, and I am an agreeable chap, so I said, sure. More legendary creatures, the merrier, as far as I'm concerned. So we designed a Kalidas.
Do you often design a card that you intend to be legendary and then creative comes up with a reason for it to be there?
Yeah, I think about maybe not half the time, but a considerable amount of the time. I will design a card usually aimed at Commander, usually at least two colors, and then it will have some mechanical tie into the set. So that, you know, like for instance, General Tazri is an ally and searches for allies and is, you know, makes all five colors available in your deck. So that was created by the design team, and the creative team came up with a story for that character.
Oh, that's great. Tazri was created by design and then integrated into the story. And deeply integrated into the story.
Yeah, absolutely. She's there throughout the entire war. She's, you know, Gideon's second in command, and eventually takes command of all of the allied forces when Gideon leaves with the Gatewatch.
How is the development experience compared to the design experience? Because development, the way it's portrayed is sort of, it's about balance, which ultimately comes down to kind of the hard numbers. And I'm not saying that you're not capable of hard numbers. I think any decent game designer has to be well acquainted with spreadsheets. But obviously the focus is different. So how did that development experience differ from your just having led a set as the lead designer?
So... being a member of a team is, of course, a much less intense experience than being the lead of a team. When you're the lead of a team, you need to maintain the whole vision and keep track of everything. When you're just a member of the team, you are sort of following the team lead's lead and, you know, just, what am I doing today, boss? Oh, we're working on this thing. That's great. We're playtesting today, or we're going over this spreadsheet, or we are quick pointing the set to see if the colors are of equal power, things like that. And, you know, obviously the team lead will communicate about what, you know, what the future plans are and everything and talk about the vision, but, you don't have to keep it all in your head. So as far as development goes versus design is very much like, here's a blank canvas, start painting, start sketching, figure out what this is supposed to be. Development is much more about refining the final product, and there's a lot more integration with other teams, integration with the creative team, integration with the editing team, to make sure that the final printed product comes off properly.
And how much tuning is done at that stage in the process?
It's almost all tuning. It's like tremendous amounts of tuning. So like play test one day, work on the set the next, rinse and repeat for months. So it's a huge amount of tuning, because we need the gameplay to be deep enough to keep our most invested players playing with the set for 3 months. And not wandering off to play some other game by some other company. We want them to play our game. So it needs to be deep.
Yeah, it has to be very replayable. Replayability is key. ultimately it's what loses players when they feel like they've exhausted all of the play options. And now is this, and please forgive me for being ignorant of this, is this your first time being a developer? Or being on the development team?
No, I was on the Magic 2013 development team very early in my career at Wizards. I was on the Commander 2013 development team. And, Magic Origins. I was on Magic Origins for a month or two toward the end. And then Shadows over Innistrad. And then I've been on another one since then. I was on the, let me think here, what was it called? The stock development team. And now I'm on the ham development team.
I love the names.
Yes.
Are you, do you guys kind of deliberately bounce between development and design, and in particular a lead role followed by a team member role?
Yeah, they usually after someone's been a lead of a set, they aren't a lead immediately after that. It gives them some time to sort of decompress and sort of digest the lessons learned from leading the set. There are some exceptions to that, like Rosewater just goes from team lead to team lead without any break in between. He's the head designer. And then every development team has a what we call a core designer, which is one of the people who specialize in the initial design on that development team, because we're a little bit better at coming up with novel card designs than the core developers. So, you know, they're very good at refining and iterating. We're more better at the sort of raw creative aspect. So, we're in there in case cards need to be designed or somebody needs to think about a more of a big picture issue that, you know, falls outside of the skill set of the core
and you're there
developers.
To protect the load-bearing walls, right?
Yeah, the load-bearing walls, which are like the mechanical underpinnings of the set that if you move them, the set deforms and falls apart. And then the color pie. We are the main resource for protecting the color pie. So that the developers don't get their fingers chopped off.
And do you always select a designer who's already lost a couple of fingers because they've learned the lessons best?
Yeah, absolutely. That's how you know that, I mean, if they've lost too many fingers, you know that they just aren't learning the lessons. But somebody like me who's lost, you know, between 3 and 5 fingers is an ideal candidate for this sort of position.
Someone who might, in extremis, be able to throw a frisbee or a baseball.
That too. We have these team building exercises.
But it's more you look at fingers over time.
Yeah.
At some point, if they're still doing it and they haven't lost any fingers for a while, then they're pretty good.
Yeah.
This is very different. So Nate and I know the video game world pretty well. We've made computer games and video games, depending on your definition of the term, really. And that sort of pacing where you're a lead and then you go into a regular team member is not common in the video game industry, which I think leads to a lot of burnout.
Yeah, we are. We try to make sure that people don't burn out here. We try to maintain good work-life balance. And then we try to, at least within R&D, have somewhat of a flat structure, at least when it comes to our teams. Like, Aaron Forsyth is the director of R&D. I had him working for me when I was the lead of Commander 2014. He was one of the designers working for me there. So, whereas he's like 3 ranks above me in the organizational structure. So we all try to do different types of jobs so that we don't burn out.
Yeah. I'm not going to get into team dynamics too much here because I'm sure that's a totally different podcast. This is Commander in, but
that's
your
right.
role in the company is different from your role on the team. And it's good to hear that you can have somebody like Aaron, be a team member who, in terms of functionality on the team, reports to a lead, but of course, is 3 levels above you in terms of corporate hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, Aaron is a terrific designer, and it's always great to have him on a design team. It's kind of a shame that he has to do all of this running of R&D, but he does a good job at it, so can't complain too much.
You know, it's usually the case where a team is as functional as and healthy as essentially the leader of that team, right? And if you have a team leader who is dysfunctional in some way or narcissistic and, you know, the team itself sort of reflects that, takes on a lot of the characteristics because that's what effectively that team leader values. And so if we unconsciously want to, and sometimes consciously, want to be appreciated by the team leader. Anyway, again, not to go into team dynamics too much, but the fact that you guys are able to turn out such high quality product and consistently is a really good sign that the team leadership there is solid. And of course, I'm talking about everybody from the team leads, but all the way up to, you know, maybe Bill Rose as well, depending on how involved he is. And I would say absolutely Bill Rose. Seems like a healthy place.
Yeah, we have an excellent team and just a very, very excellent process as far as our production pipeline goes. We've been doing this for over 20 years now, and we have worked out all the kinks at this point. Well, not all of them, but most of them. And so I don't know when the last time is that we missed a deadline for releasing a product, but I'm sure I think it's been more than 20 years.
That's another good sign, and that's a sign of a mature development organization, basically. And I don't mean that in terms of design versus developer. Neat. Okay. Hey, back to Commander and stuff, where we use small words.
Yeah, let's talk about Commander.
Small words. Is Audric a good guy or a bad guy?
You're just going to have to wait and see in the story.
Oh, you're killing me.
He is a devout worshiper of the Archangel Avacyn, who is the chief deity of Innistrad. But Avacyn, I don't know if you've been following the story, has gone blood simple and is just killing everybody. So it may be that there's some sort of crisis of faith in Odric's future.
So might he get bit by Olivio Voldaren and become a white, black, red legendary vampire?
Make it happen.
That might happen.
Because we were talking about it last time, and that's what Nate was wishing for.
You want a white, black,
can I have
red,
Kalia of the vampire, please?
White, black, red vampire?
Preferably an ally as well. All but right. one step at a time.
It doesn't have to be an ally.
All right. Well, I'll put that in my little notebook here, and I'll see what I can do.
Legendary Mardu vampire.
All right. Just make the check out to Ethan Fleischer. Okay.
Just get Olivia to bite Audric.
Yeah.
And
All right. I'll talk to the story team and
see. We already know you guys go back in time and make changes to Eldritch Moon based on the conversation we have in this podcast. So
that's right. Yeah, I mean I can definitely change that set. There's no way that it's already been printed.
No way. How sweet is that, Nate? You're about to get a Mardu vampire lord s queen. Can you call her Vampire Queen?
Woo-hoo. Sure. Well, we're going back in time. Why not?
So Madness. Madness was a challenge developmentally, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Madness is an old mechanic. I believe it's from the Torment set originally. I was asking Mark Rosewater about this. He suspects, but he's not sure, that it was designed by Mike Elliott, who is a game designer that used to work for Magic R&D, and now he makes his own games. So Madness is a mechanic that allows you, if you can manage to discard a card somehow with Madness, you can pay the Madness cost to cast it instead of putting it in your graveyard. And usually at a discount mana-wise. So this is a totally sweet mechanic because you can find ways to discard things for value. Like if you had Jace Vryn's Prodigy, you could discard a card with Madness to draw a card, but also use the Madness card. So it's a very powerful combination. And yes, that is a challenge because you're getting card advantage and you're getting a mana discount. I don't know how they do it. I don't know. I was right there the whole time. I don't know how they did it. I think we just kind of threw caution to the wind a little bit. It is like you do have to jump through hoops, right? It's hard to quantify that, but I think we did a pretty good job of quantifying it and figuring out what the madness costs should be for these various cards.
Yeah, Nate pointed out that a lot of the madness costs for the red cards with madness are also the casting cost. And so that's sort of just a facilitator for the cards that require you to discard.
That's right.
Yeah, that's a tricky balance to strike.
Yeah. But having played with the set just recently, though, and played a Madness deck, I really feel like we nailed it. It's just, it's powerful. It's great because Madness lets you feel like you're cheating. It lets you feel like you're getting away with something. Every time you do it, you're like, yes, I did it. I got away with it. Wizards of the Coast didn't think I'd outsmart them, but I did.
That's awesome. Does it also capture, because obviously we haven't played with the set yet, but does it also capture, frankly, the throwing caution to the wind feeling?
Yeah, I mean, the mechanic was named back during Odyssey Block when Torment came out, and when we were coming back to Innistrad, we knew we wanted this theme of insanity, and so we're like, oh, madness, should we do madness again? We're like, oh, God, that mechanic is really complicated and weird. But we kept thinking about it, and Mark Gottlieb, the lead designer of the set, was very excited about the idea and managed to make it all work, managed to make the whole set hang together in a way that supported madness and, you know, that enhanced the theme. I think if the mechanic had been called Florp or something, we would not have been likely to have considered it, but it was called Madness, so we considered it.
What if you had called it Mega Madness and creatures with madness came into play with a +1/+1 counter on it?
Dull.
Then it would have scored very poorly on our polling, our research. Megamorph.
Words matter.
Megamorph was, I believe, the lowest scoring mechanic of all time. And I think a lot of that is due to its name.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I don't want to go into there. As soon as I saw the I think it was a spoiler, and it was a legitimate spoiler, and it included Megamorph, I thought for certain, I was 100% certain that was a fake.
Yeah. Well, we were trying to do something there, and I don't know, it still plays well. I like playing with Megamorph cards.
Yeah,
it doesn't mind. I've got plenty of them in my cube.
Yeah, it does play well. It just is poorly named.
Yeah, well.
Now.
Oh, well. Sometimes we miss.
Yeah, well, you know. I'm sure that you can recycle that mechanic, call it something else. And I'm not being disparaging about that. I think that, you know, you can pull that out of the mental trash heap, if you will, right?
We have on occasion done that, right? Like we took Chroma, which was a very unpopular mechanic, and we rebranded it as Devotion, and everyone loved it. So sometimes these things happen.
Nate, do you have anything you want to ask about Madness?
No, but if we're talking about words, then we go on to Delirium.
Yeah.
Where you have four or more card types in your graveyard.
Right. So we wanted, in addition, we wanted a mechanic to represent this sort of descent into insanity. And I was working on the exploratory design team, and we came up with this thing that we thought was going to work. We were like, oh, we nailed it. And we iterated on it for a long time, and then we shipped it off to the design team along with, you know, all the other stuff we worked on during exploratory design. We thought it would be a slam dunk, and they hated it. They were just like, what is this? Oh, God, what were you thinking? And we're like, oh, I thought you'd like it. So Ken Nagel is one of the designers. He was on the design team, and he came up with this mechanic that we eventually named Delirium, which counts card types in your graveyard. And this worked out really well. It was great. Like, it encouraged you to make some different and exciting deck building decisions about like, oh, maybe I should put an artifact creature in here, or maybe I should put an aura in here or something so that I could get to Delirium more easily because I'll have more types of cards in my deck. So it was pretty neat. And, you know, as you lose more, either from discarding things or milling yourself or from your beloved creatures dying, you get closer and closer to Delirium.
Yeah. I played the Blessed versus Cursed dual decks. And at one point I realized I was only one card type an instant away from Delirium. And I had, I think, the Tooth Collector, and, of course, I was holding a Mind Rack Demon, which I was not about to cast without Delirium. And just found a reason to, you know, cast that instant, bam, and then I had Delirium, and I won that game, right?
Yeah, you just leveled up right there.
Oh, I set myself free, and I cast that Mind Rack Demon, and then it ate my opponent.
Yeah.
So friend of the show and Patreon patron, Robin Koss asks, he'd like to know if there were any developmental troubles when developing Delirium to work in both limited and constructed.
Absolutely. That is a major concern when you are developing a mechanic like that. You want to make sure that a mechanic isn't so much more powerful in constructed than it is in limited that it just throws everything out of whack. Certainly, you can see the power disparity in certain mechanics if you go to larger formats, right? If you look at the Delve mechanic from Khans of Tarkir, who's super powerful in Legacy and in Modern, right? To the point where we had to ban cards.
Right.
So, you know, when you make the jump from limited to constructed, sometimes you can have that huge disparity in power level. And if it's too great, then the mechanic isn't suitable. It's undevelopable. So you really need to watch out for that. Obviously, Delirium is much easier to enable in constructed than it is in limited. But we found that we were able to put enough tools into the set for limited play to beef up the power of Delirium and make it not totally equivalent to how it is in constructed, but at least in the same range.
Yeah, I'm wondering actually. So I think about it in terms of Commander and Limited, and I wonder if it's better in Limited than in Commander, because we tend to favor, I should say, cards that either perform multiple roles or are permanent.
Yeah, that's true. And also, a lot of responsible Commander players put Graveyard Hate in their deck. That's much more powerful than anything you're going to find in Shadows over Innistrad.
Wait, you're not coming out in favor of Graveyard Hate, are you?
It's not that I think that everyone should do it. It's just that I consider that sober, responsible Commander players should have enchantment removal, artifact removal, and Graveyard Hate in their decks. I am not a sober and responsible Commander player, though. Oh, yeah. I just let everyone else at the table worry about controlling the board and just try to do my crazy thing.
Okay.
What do you mean? What do you mean you allow others, like, you do your crazy thing?
I just try to have my deck do what it's trying to do. I don't generally try to disrupt my opponent's decks very much.
Mm.
I mean, I like to keep some kill spells in case someone attacks me or whatever, but,
sure.
You know, you have to Wrath every once in a while, but
yeah,
sometimes if there isn't a card that's thematically appropriate to my deck that performs one of those roles of removing artifacts or enchantments or Graveyard Hate, I just won't put it in because it doesn't fit the theme. I like to have heavily themed decks.
Yeah. Do you put Deglamour in all of your decks?
No, I don't. But like I have a Soul Shift deck with it's all the spirits from Kamigawa.
Oh, neat.
And I do put Tarashi's Grasp in there, for instance. That's an arcane spell
that can
destroy enchantments. So I'm willing to go there if it's available, and if it's not, sometimes I just won't go there.
So you'll play a Reclamation Sage in your Elf Tribal.
Sure. Yeah, I would certainly do that.
Yeah. Nate has built a couple of decks that dismantle anybody relying on the graveyard for anything except putting cards into it.
Yeah, I've often considered the idea of just making a purely hateful deck that just messes with people, but I haven't quite made the plunge yet.
Nate, his Twitter address is at Ethan Fleischer, so you can just follow him. I'm sure he'll follow back, just and you can exchange your decks with him. If you want to build a hateful deck, Nate can assist you with that.
Excellent.
Nate is vicious.
Well, currently I design my decks to hate Phil.
So. Yeah, my first stab at it was not too long ago. I tried to make a Rakdos deck. Well, not Rakdos, but, you know, Rakdos colors that just hated on green and hated on blue because those are the two most popular colors.
Excellent.
But I couldn't quite find enough hate cards to fill an entire commander deck, so I gave it up.
Oh, I can help you.
Yeah, Nate.
I have an Ashling deck.
That's true. Maybe I just wasn't looking hard enough.
Were you playing both Elemental Blasts?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Both of the red ones.
Yeah, Pyroblast and Red Elemental Blast.
Yeah, I don't know if it's such a good idea for you and Nate to talk. You seem like a nice guy, Ethan.
Yeah, I'm fairly innocent, and he might corrupt me utterly.
Yeah, and your friends would wonder what happened to you, and...
That's true. I might not be invited to the weekly commander game that the creative team runs.
Yeah.
If I did that.
And certainly wouldn't be allowed to design or develop any other commander sets.
Oh, man. That would be really sad. Because those are a lot of fun.
Because even Mark would be like, so Ethan, I hear you're being a little too mean in your commander
You've
games.
You've been seduced by the dark side.
Ah, what an appropriate metaphor, because
do your opponents use any planes or islands or non-basic lands?
Yeah there's we've got tsunami and flash fires and ruination for things like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah these are all options.
Price of progress first.
Oh yeah, of course, beforehand,
before the cleansing fires. Oh, God. Yeah, I'm supposed to play test something with Nate after this, so he's getting all primed. I'm getting all worried. Nate, I think I have to wash my hair. Investigate. That is either very cool or very bad. What are you guys, what were you guys thinking when you came up with that? What were you hoping?
We wanted to capture the idea that... we wanted to capture the idea that Jace in particular or the players themselves were trying to find out what the source of all of the troubles were on Innistrad. Clearly something weird is going down here, and we wanted to delve into that and try and find out what was happening. So we've got all these cards with Jace looking into things and looking at Tomio's journal and finding all these clues. This mechanic went through a lot of changes. This was the only mechanic that went through a significant change in development. Sometimes when we have a problem with a very defined scope, we'll form a mini team. We'll grab a few people, a few game designers, and they'll meet a few times for a week or two and just figure out solutions to a specific problem. So in this case, Sean Main led a 3-person mini team. And they worked on what should the investigate mechanic be, and they came up with a bunch of different options, and the one that Dave Humphreys, the lead developer of Shadows Over Innistrad, liked the best was this one where you got these little clue tokens, and then you could spend 2 mana and sacrifice them to draw a card. So you could investigate, find the clue, and then analyze the clue to get knowledge. It sort of plays like a cantrip in a lot of ways, where you it's a spell effect where you draw a card, but you need to find a little time there to analyze this clue. You need to find some time where you have 2 mana free and can afford to spend it. So it created a unique gameplay pattern that, you know, felt sufficiently distinct from just a regular cantrip that it was something exciting. And then, you know, there's all these like miscellaneous interactions, like, oh, here's these artifact tokens. What does that mean? How does that interact with all the rest of Magic the Gathering? There's all kinds of cards that trigger when an artifact enters the battlefield or whatever that can suddenly become this new and interesting combination.
Yeah, I think if you capitalize on that, you can make something very interesting. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say any more about that. We have a friend, Charles Moreau, who might be doing something with that. So they were artifact tokens because the metaphor is that the player is finding actual artifacts. Like all the tokens have pieces of stained glass mm-hmm. or actual objects.
Yeah, we seriously considered just making a new card type and just be like, this is just a clue. It's a permanent that's a clue. It's not an artifact or an enchantment or a creature or a land. It's just a new thing. But ultimately decided that it would be better just to make them all artifacts because then they would interact with all the rest of Magic.
Yeah. Well, pretty neat.
So it's like in Zelda games, if you have a chest, you need to spend the time to unlock it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they're in blue because blue is the appropriate color for intellectual exercises like finding clues. But did you look at it in terms of game balance and maybe, you know, like white is kind of short on clues, but they could use a little bit of card draw now.
Yeah, I mean, there is a reason that certain effects are in certain colors, and one of the reasons that white doesn't get very much card drawing is because white has all the answers. White can answer a creature, it can answer being damaged, it can answer any kind of permanent. And so if white has access to a lot of card drawing, then suddenly it doesn't need anybody else. You can just make a mono white control deck that doesn't need any other colors, and the game kind of falls apart if one of the colors can do everything it needs to do. You want to combine colors to, you know, make sure that there's lots of different decks out there.
And so did that come up in a design meeting and then like out of nowhere Mark is picking his nails with a dagger?
We had a big discussion of this, I believe, around Magic 20 or Commander 2015 design. There's an artifact creature in that set that is, it's like a big stone sphinx or something that draws a bunch of cards. And for a while, that was a white creature. It was an angel. Yeah. And Mark kind of freaked out. He was like, you can't do this. Oh, my God. And we were like, what? What's the matter? White wants to draw some cards. And so he had to explain the whole reasoning that I just explained to you guys about, you know, what the consequences are or what the consequences could be. For white getting all access to all this card drawing. We were like, oh, well, we never thought about that. It's a good thing you were here, Mark. We would have broken Magic forever. that was when some fingers were lost that day, I'm afraid.
Yeah. And this wasn't your first time because this
when
is...
When the Sphinx got consecrated?
But this wasn't your first time. I mean, this was well after Song of the
Dryads.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, that was when I lost a finger.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this, you know, this white card was not my doing.
When you see a designer or a developer kind of breaking the color pie, do you sort of just remain quiet and snicker, knowing what's about to happen?
I'll wait until they're looking the other way, and I'll kind of catch the eye of the other members of the team, and I'll make like a chopping motion at my hand, like with an imaginary cleaver.
Yeah. Yeah, and then everybody kind of has to stifle a snicker. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, these are the way lessons are learned. Transform changed a little bit.
Yeah, we wanted to try a few minor new things with Transform. So this was a mechanic that came back from the original Innistrad block. Tom Lapilli, who no longer works for Wizards, I'm afraid. He got tired of us and went to go work somewhere else. We miss him. But he kind of stole the idea for double face cards from Duel Masters, which is another trading card game that we make for the Japanese market. And you know, he had the idea to take this mechanic and bring it into Magic. And so it's mostly recognizable as the same mechanic from the original Innistrad, but we did find some new twists and, you know, here's a creature that transforms into a sorcery and things like that. So there's a few cool new ideas there that make it a little fresher.
What was the reason behind changing the power and toughness of the transform creatures? They used to be exactly double the sum on the transformed side as it was on the first side.
I had no idea. Yeah. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah, it was one of the things Mark pointed out in his podcast. And then, of course, coming back this time, it looks like they're, on average, 2 total power and toughness better.
Oh, well. Yeah, I did not hear a whisper of that the entire time we were working on the set. So I couldn't say. Maybe it was an idea that everyone got tired of, or maybe just everyone forgot about it.
What is the thing in the ice?
Yeah, who made thing in the ice?
I don't know who made thing in the ice. That wasn't one of the questions you guys sent me beforehand. Yeah, I don't know. It's a sweet card, though. I love that kind of card. I love those kind of blue cards that make you play with lots of instants and sorceries. It's going right in my cube as soon as I get my copy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really nice.
It'll probably go in my Prime Speaker Zagana Commander deck also, because it is a Kraken, right, on the other side? Yeah, yep. So this is
Kraken Horror.
All the cards are creatures of the briny deep in my Prime Speaker Zagana deck. So I think that Thing in the Ice might make the cut. We'll see if I have enough instants and sorceries to actually flip the thing.
Creatures of the briny deep. So you're ensuring that Prime Speaker is going to draw a lot of cards.
Yeah, there are a lot of very large, very old, very terrible sea monsters in this deck. But they do have a lot of power and toughness, so she usually draws me quite a few cards. But I have a lot of those various auras that you can put on your opponent's lands to turn them into islands. Some of them very, very bad. But that's what you need.
Do you like Quicksilver Fountain?
Yeah, Quicksilver Fountain is in there. So it is it's not a powerful deck. Doesn't have good cards in it, but you can only be attacked by so many 6/6 island walking creatures before you just die.
Yeah, sea serpents gotta attack. So
yep.
You need those island changers.
Yep.
Do you have a Segovian Leviathan in it?
No, that card did not make the cut.
No?
The very worst of the Leviathans and such did not make the cut. But there were some pretty dodgy ones in there for a while. I had Vodalian Serpent in there, which I don't know if you remember that card, but it is one of the worst Magic cards of all time.
No, I don't even know it.
It was like from Invasion Block. It was like a 2/2 that couldn't attack unless your opponent had an island, and it cost like 4 mana or something. But you could kick it, and it would enter with 4 +1/+1 counters. It had a kicker cost. So, but yeah, eventually I had to cut that one. It just wasn't good enough. We've made a lot of good Krakens and Leviathans in the last couple of years with Theros Block and such. Yeah. So I don't need to stoop to such depths.
A 6/6 for 6 that requires Defender have an island. Yeah. That's great. I don't know. It's still better than Segovian Leviathan.
That's true. That card is bad.
I mean, that's when 3/3s were huge.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of really terrible cards in the Legends set. It is not the not the high point of Magic design or Magic power levels.
As the resident or present expert on creatures from the briny deep, would you say the Segovian Leviathan is largely made of fat?
Largely made of fat. Why do you ask?
I mean, because it's such a big creature, but it's only a 3/3.
It's not. It's from... I'm going to go into storyline goob here, mode here. Segovia is a plane where everything is miniature. So it's a huge for a creature of Segovia, but everything is tiny there.
Whoa.
I'm not even making this up.
Wait.
Dude.
Where do I...
Like there, you can if you look at the art, there's these little whales in the art, scale whales, as it were, and they're much smaller than the Leviathan. Those things would be like minnows if you summoned them to a plane with regular people.
All right, I think we'll leave that one there.
Yeah.
Wow. God, you're killing me here too.
We have one mechanic left to talk about. Should we talk about one more mechanic?
You want to talk about Skulk?
Let's talk about Skulk. So the insanity mechanic that I alluded to earlier when talking about Delirium wanted you to get through with creatures and hit people. And whenever you hit someone, you would mill them for a certain amount of cards. And so there was a need for small creatures that had an evasive ability because you wanted to mill them out before you killed them with damage. Otherwise, what would be the point of milling them? So both I and Mark Rosewater came up with the Skulk mechanic on the same day, completely separately. And it means that the creature with Skulk can't be blocked by creatures with greater power. So it's kind of based on like Amru Kithkin from Legends. Things like that.
Right.
Though there's nothing with that exact mechanic been printed yet. But we didn't need it anymore when we got rid of that mechanic, but it was such a cool, flavorful, like, I'm a sneaky guy, it's Innistrad, and everything's dark, and I'm going to sneak on past, that we kept it in the set because we liked the way it played.
Yeah, it plays pretty well. Is that going to be an evergreen mechanic?
Well, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. We're going to play with it. We'll see what the players think, but, you know, it's worth considering.
Yeah. Well, Audric likes
it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, he likes it enough to give it to everybody.
That's right.
Yeah. But not infect.
See that guy do what he's doing.
No Audric infect decks.
Mm-hmm.
No, he only likes evergreen keywords and keywords from Shadows Over Innistrad.
All right.
But not triggered abilities.
No, he
either.
Doesn't like triggered abilities that much.
Hates them. Too complicated
that's just,
for Audric.
That's just a little much. He's just a simple soldier.
Yeah. Well, he's got to be pissed at Sorin.
Yeah, I don't know if he even knows anything about Sorin.
Oh, yeah, because Sorin isn't clearly... Like, he hasn't come out and said, I am the master of this
plane. He's, you know, some people know about it, but I don't know if the humans know about it.
Yeah. What's this allusion to his grandfather or somebody?
Sorin's grandfather, I believe, is named Edgar Markov, and he is the first vampire of Innistrad. He made some kind of demonic pact for immortality. So all of the vampires on Innistrad are descended from his bloodline.
Hmm. So Olivia's related to Sorin?
I mean, in that they're both vampires, and vampires can make other vampires, but Edgar Markov was the first one. I believe Sorin is literally Edgar Markov's grandson. I don't think Olivia is, like, genetically related to Edgar Markov, but I'm not sure. I'm not an expert on interplanar genealogy.
Got it.
So if Jace is the private investigator behind the scenes in this set, is Tamio going to be... Mm-hmm. The private investigator in the next set, and there are going to be more clues and investigating.
Well, you're just going to have to wait and see what happens in the next set. It's possible that it will have a very different theme that has nothing to do with investigating, but she will have a fairly clearly defined archetypal role in this storyline that once you see it will be familiar to you, I think.
Nate, my guess is we're going straight to survival horror.
Dun, dun, dun.
Instead of clue tokens, you'll be finding food cache artifact tokens.
Could be. We've had this idea knocking around that sometime when we go to Innistrad, we should go to some other continent, to the continent where the naughty teenagers are on spring break and going into abandoned houses and things.
Or maybe you could make an artifact creature that was legendary and could turn all the clue tokens into thopters.
Oh.
Some sort of queen of the thopters, as it were.
This doesn't fall into unsolicited, does it?
Probably.
Well, we're not specifying mechanics. We're
That's
giving
true.
You inspiration.
That's true. Yeah. You're just saying Thopter Queen.
Yeah, just vague suggestions.
Vague suggestions like turning clues into artifact creatures.
All right, I better get out of here before I open us to serious legal risk here.
Yeah, yeah. We actually asked the rhetorical question in there. How difficult was it to pick perfect mechanics? Because you guys did.
It was difficult. It's always difficult. This set went more smoothly than many, though. When I was on the development team and the handoff from design was a very solid set, so we just had to not break it, basically. We were like, we don't like this investigate mechanic. We're going to fix that. Everything else looks pretty good. We're just gonna massage it a little bit. So this was a very smooth handoff, and we like smooth handoffs. So we didn't have to change a lot, and Mark Gottlieb's original vision for the set was terrific, and I think it's one of the best sets we've ever made.
Yeah, it's fantastic, very flavorful. We didn't even talk about your involvement in Commander, except for a couple of references here and there, but are you involved in Commander 2016?
I'm afraid I can't talk about that yet, but I'll just say that of the members of R&D, I am the most involved in Commander-related projects, so you might just see my name in the credits for something at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll be announcing that not in too much longer. So you'll get to find out all about it.
Well, we look forward to that.
All right.
We are, as you may have surmised before even your first appearance, a Commander-oriented podcast. Nate, do you want to talk about this message of the week?
Oh, yeah. So we're looking at the art for Malevolent Whispers, and it looks like Kyle MacLachlan is doing this crazy face.
I did not notice that looked like Kyle MacLachlan until you mentioned it, but it could be. Sometimes the artists use famous people as photo reference or whatever, so that could be. He looks a lot wrinklier than Kyle MacLachlan, though. I don't know. Could be, though.
Yeah. It's a really good representation of his character in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah, could be. There's no telling. People get inspiration from all kinds of places. I feel confident that the art direction did not specify Kyle MacLachlan, though.
Yeah, probably not, right? It's almost the end of the show. Do you have any questions for us?
How do you do it? How do you do this week in and week out for very little pay and almost no recognition? What keeps you going?
It's those morsels of pay and recognition that keep us going.
This might be a good time to mention the Patreon again.
No, really, you know, so we just ran a contest, and a lot of the entries included... a couple of them were incredibly efficient. Just, you know, I had my son and my daughter read, and by reading the cards, I mean, they opened packs of Oath of the Gatewatch, and my daughter invented this system like 4 years ago, where she just goes like, she says, oh, that's, you know, three ghost pieces and one dewdrop for, you know. And she does that with all of the mana symbols. And I realized, like, oh, wow, this is a great way to kind of mask the identities of the cards. And then she talks about what's on the card in terms of artwork and she uses the word thing an awful lot. So we created a contest where we had my daughter read a pack and we had my slightly older son read a pack using the same convention she uses. And anybody who gets all of the cards in the pack correct will be eligible to win, and we'll select from among those people who do it to win one of our playmats. And, I know your work address. Stroking my beard. And anybody who gets over 11 gets a pack of card. But, so we had a couple that were really efficient, long story short, right? And... others, though, would write like, hey, we really like what you're doing. This is a really fun show. And that is truthfully why we do it.
I have to say that having seen the response from the last time I was on the show, I got more Twitter comments, people talking to me on Twitter after that show than any other podcast I've been on. You have a very enthusiastic fan base. I think it's great.
Awesome. Yeah, we love them. And you know, this is sort of unintentionally segueing into our standard outro. And our outro is this because we do love our listeners. We genuinely do, right? And their enthusiasm is wonderful, and it keeps me, Nate, and Sean, when Sean can make it, coming back and doing this again and again. And it's because it's not easy.
No. The way you guys do it is not the easy way.
No. There's a ton of editing, and there's a ton of equipment we purchase and stuff. And really, you know, even if we hit our goal, our Patreon goal, and I'm not trying to plug that right now, but there it is. We're not in any way making money off of this. We're simply staunching the flow of blood.
Yeah, yeah.
but it's, you know, when we interact with the listeners, and it's like Johnny Crass, who you've seen tonight, Dercoke XXL, and Rogue Artificer, and I can actually keep going, and I'm stopping myself right now, and not because I don't want to call them out, but just because there are dozens of people we talk to all the time, and that just keeps us coming back. And I'm sure you guys get it too.
Oh yeah, we have fans that we regularly interact with, and fans that we, you know, only meet when we go to Gen Con. But it's really great, you know, to be able to see how our work is improving the lives of other people, and you know, letting them have fun in times that, you know, necessarily aren't that fun.
Yeah, Nate and I both worked on a title called Multiplayer Battletech. And for me, for a while, it was actually like my life was Multiplayer Battletech. When I wasn't playing Magic, because the team taught me Magic. Anyway, and this was back in 1994. And we would run into people just like, you know, you guys do when Mark quotes those letters he gets, whose lives were changed by the game. You know, and pardon me while I choke back some emotions here, but they describe how multiplayer Battletech, as simple as an interface as it was, by today's standards especially, brought these people out and gave them a social experience that they would not have had otherwise because of various insecurities or actual disabilities, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that insecurity is not a disability. When it's really severe, it is. But I mean, people who just couldn't get out of the house,
yeah,
because of medical reasons. And the game brings that social connection to them. And Magic does that very much, right? And being one small little moon orbiting the Magic planetoid thing, it's, you know, we see some of that. And the people who appreciate us let us know, and they tell us, and it's just wonderful. So that's what keeps us coming back.
Excellent. That sounds like a good answer. I like it.
Nate also likes tormenting me when we play test games. I'm not going to go through the outro. To our listeners, the outro is the way we exit the show normally. Mm-hmm. Just the credits. Nate created our theme song. Oh, do you interact with Blake? Were you there when he heard the song that Nate wrote?
No, I don't know anything about this.
too bad, because I would love to know his reaction.
Yeah, sorry.
Nate wrote our theme song, and so I'm just saying, if you ever need a theme song for anything, Nate is available.
All right.
Our logo was created by Mr. Picto with assistance from Kelly. Always special thanks to our tech whizzes, Jesse Thompson, Graham Frank, and to Justin for his server space. And, of course, very special thanks to, all our patrons on Patreon. And I'm going to call out Robin, Alex, Bradford, and Jackie. And I need to get up to Patreon to see if any other folks have joined the $10 level. Because what we do with them, I said that they had helped us with some of the some of this episode. What we do with them is we ask them questions and say, what do you think? Should we cover this topic? Should we address this? And they're really helping us. That's wonderful. So, yay. Thanks, folks. I'm kind of spent after that long BattleTech thing. You can reach us by going to our website, commanderandmtg.com. Our email is cass@commanderandmtg.com. You can find us on all the social media that matters. I know I'm not saying it, Nate, not saying it. By searching for Commander and MTG Podcast. Ethan, ordinarily I ask before we go through the outro, but how can people reach you if they want to reach you?
So you can reach me by email, ethan.fleischer@wizards.com. Or if you want to have a conversation in a virtual public space, I'm on Twitter @EthanFleischer.
Wow. Ethan, we're not going to put your Wizards email address in the show notes.
All right.
So our listeners are going to have to go back and listen to that. And what I'm doing is, I'm sure Wizards has wonderful spam filters, but I'm saving them a little bit of energy from having to scroll.
All right.
Because believe me.
Thank you on behalf of our technical support team.
Individually on Twitter, I'm @KetJack.
I'm @MrPlorg.
Sean is @Copain26. And Ethan, would you take us out with a "and that's our show" or anything else you want to say?
Thanks for having me on the show, guys. It was a monumental pleasure. And that's our show.
Thank you for coming on the show. The pleasure was all ours. It's wonderful to have you here.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we'll see you next set.
All right.
Mandarin.
Gitrog monster, qui es in celis, sanctificetur nomen tuum. Gitrog monster, qui es in celis, sanctificetur nomen tuum. Rock,